we're off to a great start, and we missed the first 15 minutes of class. So that's not good. All righty. Onward to multimedia networking. Okay. So, in multimedia networking, there are a lot of standardized protocols that are public in the IETF RFCs, and then there are a whole lot of protocols that are proprietary to various vendors like Skype and Real Networks and the like. So, it's not really possible to be exhaustive in covering everything that goes on in the multimedia area. There are probably hundreds of these specs now, but there are a few that are of interest in as sort of general background and examples of the kinds of things you'll find. So one of them is the real-time streaming protocol. It's worth writing that down. Oh, we're back to this nonsense again where it writes in some place other than where I write, so we'll just give up on that. Real-time streaming protocol. So part of the problem with these protocol names is that they sometimes are pretty misleading about what they actually do. The names are misleading about what they do. The real-time streaming protocol doesn't actually have anything to do with the packets that are part of the stream, right? It's a control protocol. It says what packets should the server now be sending to the client. So it has things like play and pause and stop, identify a particular stream to be played, and so on and so forth. But it doesn't actually contain the data that's being transferred, and that's the subject for other protocols. So we'll look at what it does. Rewind, fast forward. The issue about real-time streaming protocol is how do you synchronize the activity of the control activities with the actual media being streamed. How do you couple those together? So the technique being used here is called out-of-band control. We didn't look at FTP, the file transfer protocol, because its use is pretty well deprecated. Notice the word is deprecated, not depreciated. Deprecated in the internet today because of the insecurities that it has. It requires plain text passwords, and those are not a good idea. So FTP has sort of fallen out of use. We didn't talk about it, but like RTSP, it uses control messages that are sent on a different set of ports than the media that is being streamed or the files that are being fetched. And so this is called out-of-band control. Protocols like SSH and SCP use in-band control. They make a single connection and then do multiplexing of the control messages with the data messages by having a sort of fancier in-band protocol to tear that all apart. Okay, so here's sort of how it goes, and we'll see how this happens. The web browser is fetching some media. The media is described by a metafile like we talked about last time. The browser, based on the type information contained in the metafile, launches some media player, and the player sets up the control connection to the streaming server. So, a metafile may contain alternatives for the audio and the video, for that matter. Here's a metafile that describes two different alternatives for the audio, one being a low fidelity and one being a high fidelity, high bandwidth one. The browser is going to have to choose which of those it wants to have played. There's also some video that's going to get streamed here along with the audio. And notice that these are described, the video and the audio here are described by separate sources. It's going to be the browser's job to synchronize the playback of those two sources with help from the data that it gets from the streams. All right. So, this should be a surprise. The web browser fetches the metafile. The media player then gets invoked with the metafile and issues the setup, play, commands. The streaming happens. We can pause. We can tear down. Not very exciting. Interestingly enough, RTSP borrows some of the inspiration from HTTP about how to build a protocol. It uses plain text messages, unlike, say, FTP, which has everything encoded in binary messages. So you can easily see within the packets, if you run Wireshark on an RTSP protocol, a running protocol, you can look at the bytes in the data packets and see readable language. You can tell what's going on. Okay, so the client does the setup message, the server, see here for client, S for server, the server issues a response. It looks like a HTTP response, except it says RTSP, and it identifies the session. The client then continues to interact with the server by sending things like the play, pause messages, always identifying the session and telling it what it wants to do. Okay, but notice that there's no data here. This is just the control, and the data will be sent on a different connection. Okay. So that's how we sort of get it going. Then we have the issue of, this is a multimedia file. We talked about how best effort service is not the ideal foundation on which to do things that have real-time requirements. So we'll talk about some techniques for how that's handled. Oh, I don't know. This is just some examples of applications. Skype for PC to PC communication. I guess a lot of instant messaging systems these days have the ability to handle voice messaging. PC to PC. There are bridges that will connect those. Digital phone, PC-based phone systems into the actual phone network. That's fun. So you can make calls from your PC directly to a phone out there in the world. And then you can do video conversations with various applications. They all have similar issues in that, you know, it's a two-way conversation. There's a latency requirement for having adequate perceived quality on the part of a human being at either end. And the system has to somehow cope with that. Okay, so for audio, it's kind of interesting. Audio is maybe a little easier than video in some respects. People speak in bursts. And I tend to speak in a lot of bursts. I tend to stop a lot. Some people talk continuously, but I tend to stop a lot, I think. So I talk for a while, and then I don't talk for a while. And that silent period actually gives the whole system a chance to sort of reset and recalibrate. So every spurt can be handled separately. Typically they're handled separately. The silence is just no data needs to be sent for silence, right? You just send data when there's data to be sent. There are some techniques and tricks in players to, especially for phone conversations, to replace silence with a little bit of noise. It turns out that people are very disconcerted if you're talking on the phone and there's absolute silence coming into your ear. You think you've lost the connection. So the players will sometimes generate some noise during silent periods, but you don't have to send any data to accomplish that. A typical choice might be 20 milliseconds at a time of audio, sampled at 8 kilobytes per second, maybe. So that means that each sample, each chunk is going to be 160 bytes of data. Right? Now, remember, you have to add in, for the network requirement, any overheads associated with that data. So if you're sending UDP packets, that's a UDP header plus an IP header, which is how many bytes? TCP plus IP is 40, but UDP isn't quite that much. And then multiply that out and you see how much bandwidth you actually require when somebody is talking, but when they're silent, it goes to zero. We also need some headers to describe what it is that we're sending. What sequence number is associated with this data, and what time. It turns out knowing both of those things is very helpful to the player to get this to come out sounding good. What happens if a packet is lost? Okay. So we've talked about this before. A 20 millisecond chunk missing out of a audio stream, voice audio in particular, is not very significant. You'll hear a little click or something as somebody's talking and suddenly there's silence for 20 milliseconds and then it comes back. But tolerable, at least as far as communicating, maybe not very pleasant. The other possibility is that the chunk arrives too late to be of use, right? Every chunk, when you're playing back a sequence of continuous speech, every chunk has to be played at a particular time. If it's not there yet, it has to be left out. And even if it arrives later, it's of no use. It has to be thrown away. Okay, so where do delays come from? Well, the obvious places, the processing in the source, the processing in the destination, queuing in the network, transmission time, propagation delay, all those things contribute to the total delay. And then, as we'll see, in order to tolerate jitter, we're going to add some extra delay. Actually mentioned that before. So you don't want to go over 400 milliseconds, and already that's pretty unpleasant. Okay. Yeah.
So then do they have like an algorithm or something they try to use, or if they lose a packet, it might try to fill in what?
We'll talk about that here in a second. Yeah. There are various ways of doing that. There are ways of actually encoding some redundancy in the stream so that you have something to play that the sender specified, or you could just try to guess, right? And both of those are possible. So we talked about this before. The client imposes a playout delay on top of all the other delays, right? The total delay here is not only the client playout delay, but also the delay that happens between the sender and the receiver in the network. So it's this total amount that you want to keep under 400 milliseconds. But you have to cope with the variability of the delay, the jitter. So there are a couple different approaches here. One is that the receiver just makes a sort of, we'll call it best effort guess at what delay it ought to impose on the for its playout delay. So the chunks arrive with a particular timestamp, and the receiver plays them back at some later timestamp, T plus Q. And Q is unchanging. If the chunk arrives after T plus Q, it's too late and it's lost. So you can see that if we choose a large Q, this is Q in that later slide. If we choose a large Q, then we have very little chance that we'll run out of data and have to make silence. If we move the blue line over closer to the black line, the blue staircase over closer to the black staircase, you can see that if we move it too far, there will be times when the place that we're supposed to be playing out hasn't arrived yet. And that would be a bad thing. So big playout delay is good for not having silences, but it's bad for the reasons we talked about before, that you want to have a small delay to be really a high-quality connection. Oh, well, okay. This shows what I was just trying to illustrate on that previous slide, that if you move Q too small, then you run out of data. Okay. So the problem, of course, with choosing a fixed Q is that it is completely oblivious to what's really going on in the network. And the question is, adapt to what really is happening? And hopefully you'll see a connection here to something we talked about before. We'll see. Okay. I'm going to test you on this. So, adaptive playout design is that we try to estimate the network delay and adjust the playout delay at the beginning of each talk spurt. This is where the silences are good, right? Because they give you a chance to sort of reset the playout delay with every talk spurt. Okay? If you were playing music or something that was continuous, you'd have to be a lot cleverer to sort of paste together an adjustment in the playout delay so that it didn't sound really weird. Right? So the silent periods shrink and expand as you change the playout delay, but you know, who notices? It's silence. Okay, but while the chunk is being played out, the delay is fixed, and so it's still every 20 milliseconds. So it goes. So here's how we do it. We estimate the average delay after receiving every packet. And the way we do it is we take the previous delay, multiply it by a number 1 minus u, where u is a number between 0 and 1, and multiply the current sample by u. Okay? So where u is a fixed constant between 0 and 1. Very important. Does this remind you of anything? This formula? Have we seen this before? What? Estimating round trip time. It's exactly the same formula. It's an exponential moving average, an exponentially smooth moving average. So old samples gradually fade away and new ones come into prominence, but not too fast, right? Because they're suggesting here a U of 0.01%. So it's not going to change very fast. I guess for TCP, the recommendation is about 1/8 for U here. So that's a much more sensitive to changes than this is. Okay. And like for the round trip time estimation, it's useful to have an estimation of the deviation, the amount by which the delay changes. That is, in some sense, the jitter, right? If you're seeing a lot of changes in the delay, that means that sometimes it's really short and sometimes it may be quite a bit longer. And you don't want to set your delay, your playout delay too short, because then you'll miss those longer, those packets that arrive with longer delay. So again, we've made the same computation for TCP. Again, we use a exponentially smoothed moving average, and we set the playout delay. This is the playout delay, di plus kvi. We set that as having a floor of the average plus some multiple of the deviation. Okay? Because remember, it's good to keep it small, but you want it to be big enough. Okay? So sort of no surprise there. The question is, so where do all these numbers come from? Got a slide about that. Yes. Why do we have all these numbers? So it's important at the media player to know whether your packet is the first one in a talk spurt, because that's the place you're allowed to change the playout delay. So in order to do that, the protocols for actually conveying the media, as opposed to RTSP that doesn't. The protocols for conveying the media typically include both a packet timestamp and a packet sequence number. So with both of those things, you can tell whether a packet that you're looking at now is the one right after the previous packet, and whether it follows it immediately in time. Okay. If you don't have both of those things, you can't do that. Right? If you only have the timestamps, you would, if a packet were lost, you would say a new talk spurt is beginning, even though this was part of a previous one that for which there was a missing packet. So having the sequence numbers as well lets you say, yes, this is a packet, there's a gap, but it is really the next packet and the beginning of a talk spurt. Okay. Questions about that? And it's at the TalkSport boundary that you can change the delay. So, now, your question about what do we do if there is loss. A number of techniques have been designed to do this. One is to do something similar to parity checking. And this is also a technique that's used in RAID arrays, if you know about RAID arrays of disks. Take n block. Let me do something here. I really want to be able to draw. I just really want to be able to draw. So I can draw them here. So I've got some chunks. They're all the same size. Doesn't look like it. They're all the same size. They're all 20 milliseconds. They all have the same amount of data in them. If I XOR all those data chunks together, I compute what? The parity of the columns. Right? If I stack these up, it's one way to draw this, and do XOR between all of them, I end up with parity. For each column. And if I don't receive one of those packets, I can use the parity to recover the contents. Right? By XORing all of this stuff together, I get back this. All right? So that's what they're talking about as the first technique here. Instead of sending n chunks, I send n plus 1 chunks. That has overhead 1 over n. But if any one of those n chunks is missing, I can replace it using the parity chunk. So the problem here is that if you want to do this, you have to wait for the parity chunk to show up. You have to establish your playout delay long enough so that the parity chunk shows up before you start playing even the first packet, because the first packet might not be there. The first chunk might not be there. Right? And you don't have the opportunity sort of in real time to accommodate that. You have to have planned for it by having a big enough playout delay. So that's the playout delay problem. And the opposite problem is that if you choose a small n, which would limit the playout delay issue, then you're having to have a higher overhead, right? The lowest n you could choose would be 1, right? So you send the packet and you send it again, basically. Then you're wasting 50% of the bandwidth. Two chunks and it's a third, three chunks and it's a quarter, and so on and so forth. So it's a trade-off. Okay, second scheme is again, help from the sender. We send, along with each chunk, a lower quality version of the previous chunk. So we just, what's called, downsample it. So maybe this is 64 kilobits per second. This is a compressed stream that's maybe 8 kilobits per second. And so now if a chunk is missing, well, that was number 3. When number 4 shows up, I have the ability at the receiver, the player, to expand the compressed audio into a fuller version and play that instead. So this will be lower quality, but you know, we already said that a completely missing 20 millisecond chunk was not so awful. This is an improvement in that it's a lower quality version of those 20 milliseconds. Okay, got another one. This is kind of crazy. Basically, the theory here is if it's not so bad to lose 20 milliseconds, then it must be even less bad to lose 5 milliseconds. So instead of sending the first, well, they've called them units here. So they take the 20 milliseconds and divide it up into 4 pieces of 5 milliseconds each and spread those across 4 different packets. Okay? So now we have to wait, again, we have to wait 4 chunk times before we can start playing anything, because we need to have 1, 2, 3, and 4 units from that first chunk in order to play the first 20 milliseconds of audio. But by waiting for those 4, then we at worst lose a much smaller subpiece, but multiple times over that 80 millisecond interval. Okay? So it doesn't have any bandwidth overhead, but again, the more packets you do this over, the more subunits that you choose to use, the longer the playout delay has to be, because you have to wait for all of these to show up. Okay, so those are all sender-assisted techniques to handling loss. And then there are the other ones, which are, and I can't write, but I can write on the other one. Yeah, all right. So those were sender-assisted. And then the pure receiver methods, for coping with packet loss. One, insert silence. And what you'll hear there is a click, really, kind of sound. The other possibility is to interpolate. Well, before we do that, replace with preceding packet, preceding chunk. Okay, so we just go ahead and play the same thing that we heard in the previous 20 milliseconds. Or 3, be a little smarter and use both sides and say interpolate between them. Okay, now, ways of doing this and the perceptions that people have of that are actually studied by people who do human experiments, right? And then we'll ask people, you know, what's better? What do you like better? What's your perception of the quality of this stream when this is happening? They'll ask. And they'll ask it not, you know, just for a single instance, but say for 10% packet loss or 15 or 20 or so on and so forth. And try to get an understanding of what people perceive as quality in audio stream. Okay? So that's kind of interesting. It's where the technology meets the wetware, as they call it. All right? So, I think we'll stop there. We'd better. Class time is over. And I'll see you on Monday when we'll, I think, finish up this media, multimedia stuff and move on to security. Next chapter.